This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Hi, Amelie. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi. You know, we put a call out to listeners a few days ago to share stories about empathetic joy with us, and you left us a really beautiful message, and I wanted to share it more broadly with On Point listeners, Amelie. So I'm wondering if you could just start by telling us the story of your friend Gina. When did you first meet?
Yeah, so we met as kids. We were in junior high together, which is 7th and 8th grade. It became fast friends at school. And, you know, I went to a different high school, so we drifted apart a little bit, but loosely stayed in touch and reconnected again in our 20s.
Reconnected again. Okay. And what brought you together? What allowed for that reconnection?
So I had seen on, I believe it was Facebook or social media, that she had been diagnosed with leukemia. And so, of course, you know, my heart went out to her and I reached down again, I believe over text.
Okay. And so then what happened after that?
Yeah. So she was kind of in and out of treatment eventually for years. And I stuck by her through a lot of those kind of rounds of ups and downs, but also I was dealing with my own unrelated but related to cancer decisions for myself, and as two people who were quite young and dealing with that sort of thing, it really brought us together.
So you were there for each other in the time of. Sounds like you're both a mutual greatest need, but she did pass away, you said.
Yep, in the pandemic.
Oh yeah. So that must have been really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, what's interesting is that your experience of empathetic joy that led you to call us begins with the story of Gina. But it's with somebody else and something else that happened to a colleague of yours that made you resonate with joy. Can you tell us that?
Yeah, exactly. So so at the time I was working in sales, and I was working closely with somebody who was much, much older than myself or Gina, but also was dealing with cancer treatment. And we weren't very close personally, myself and my colleague, but we worked together every day. So we had a kind of a closer professional relationship. And she, you know, was very positive, super smart, you know, really good at what she does. And very, very, like I said, very kind of positive about things. And I just remember one day she walked into the office and looked at me and was like, "My cancer markers are down." And I remember just feeling what I describe now as an electric shock. Like I remember just going like, yes, you know, kind of in the same way that people who just saw their favorite team score a goal or whatever, you know, like I was like, yes, of course. I was like, no way. Like, this is great. And just feeling that kind of elation and like truly for her, but also kind of based on the understanding and my own personal knowledge of what that could feel like, kind of at my core.
Tell me more though about it. Like, it sounds like it was almost not just an emotional feeling, but or even a spiritual feeling, but even almost this like a physical reaction you had.
Yeah. As I describe it, I'm like tensing my arms, you know, and I'm like turning into like a tense, excited muscle, you know, and it's just really electrifying. I think.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit more about how you think your ability to experience that joy relates to, you know, not just your own story with cancer, but thinking back to Gina, where we started. Like, how do you think all those things are wound together that led you to experience that electric moment of happiness for someone else?
Yeah, I mean, I'm of the philosophy that I don't have to experience something exactly in order to feel it for somebody else. I think we kind of borrow from our experiences and our feelings to feel something like empathetic joy. And so with with cancer, you know, anyone who's had any experience with, you know, a loved one or personally or anything with that treatment, you know, it's really a lot of waiting. It's not, it's usually not like a one and done sort of deal. And so waiting can feel quite gloomy. And it can feel like positive news is kind of an impossibility. Even though we know statistically it can be quite positive and, you know, treatment can work, to kind of see that right in front of me in my colleague, it let me say, oh, it can work. Mm. And this is really meaningful, not just for me and not just for my friend, but for anybody who feels that what they're going through is not, is insurmountable. But it can happen, you know, like we can get through. And here was the evidence right in front of me.
Yeah. How are you doing now?
I'm doing well. Yeah. I don't work for the same company anymore. I work at a different one, and you know, I'm super happy and really grateful for a lot of the different lessons that I've learned from my friend. Hmm.
And do you think that now, because of this experience, that maybe it'll be possible for you, or you'll be seeking out more moments to experience that kind of like really profound empathetic joy?
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the things kind of learned from the experience is that I feel that I can recognize potential for that feeling in other people. So, you know, when different colleagues perhaps or friends are struggling with something, I really see it and understand the weight of it and understand how important it is to, you know, for them to know that these challenges are surmountable, you know, and yeah, I feel that I can recognize those things to a much greater degree than I could before.
Mm-hmm. Well, Amelie, an On Point listener in Massachusetts, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And the reason why we wanted to share Amelie's story more broadly is because this hour we're exploring this idea of empathetic joy. It's an ancient Buddhist virtue, and it's a concept that's centuries old in Buddhism. But recently, researchers have begun to understand the science of why we experience, as Amelie said, not just emotionally and spiritually, but even sometimes physically, empathetic joy when witnessing the true profound happiness in someone else. So that's what we're going to explore today. And to help us do that, I want to bring in Shelley Gable. She's a professor and chair of the psychological and chair of the psychological and brain sciences department at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and principal investigator at the Emotions, Motivation, Behavior, and Relationships Lab. Professor Gable, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. So you heard Amelie's story there. Can you just describe to me sort of what was going through your mind as she was describing her experience of empathetic joy?
Yes, there's a lot of things going through my mind based on our research. It was a lovely story. First thing I picked up on was kind of the closeness that she described between both her friend that unfortunately passed away, but also her colleague. And having that mutual understanding. And what we found is that these sharing of positive emotions, these sharing of joy, often happens in the context of close relationships or, you know, people that we know fairly well. And it's both a product of kind of our mutual understanding of one another, but also it helps those moments of shared joy. We've also found really help build relationships and help kind of build that understanding and sense of shared purpose and shared self. So these moments are not only, you know, again, products of our relationships, but they're building blocks of our relationships.
Okay. So tell me more then about the basics of what is happening in the brain when... We'll get to the empathetic joy part in a second, but when like we're just experiencing our own personal moments of joy, how does science recognize what's going on in the brain during those moments?
Right. Well, I must first say that science is often focused on some of the more negative emotions that we've experienced, yeah. But with that caveat, you know, there's a lot of activity going on in the brain when we experience positive emotions, of course, and there's a lot of dopamine release and you know, neurotransmitters such as related to those systems. So there's a lot going on. So when we experience empathetic joy, we often, there's a few studies that show that there are similar patterns in the brain from when you experience your own joy to when you experience other people's joy. It's not quite as a strong as a reaction, so to speak, or as much activity as we see when we look at the difference between, for example, people experience negative emotions and trying to be empathetic and experience other people's negative emotions. But it's still a very kind of mirror system that we're seeing with empathetic joy versus your own personal joy.
Okay, mirror system. So, but does that mean that that internally to the person experiencing the empathetic joy, that what's going on in the brain, is it, just to be clear, is it similar to what would be happening in, you know, personal moments of personal joy?
So far, that's what the data seem to suggest. Okay. But again, there aren't that many studies, to be honest with you, of positive emotions and what's going on in the brain, especially in empathetic joy, and you know, these empathetic experiences.
Okay. Well, I think we need more, right?
Exactly.
In this day and age. Okay. So, but why do you think, you know, it's interesting because people often just presume that negative emotions, I've heard this a lot, right? That negative emotions are, they're contagious. But what you're saying, and it seems that research is beginning to show, is contagious even the right word to use when it comes to more positive emotions?
I'd love to be able to use that term. And I think that there's a lot of good behavioral evidence, not necessarily, you know, looking at activity in the brain, but there's a lot of behavioral evidence that positive emotions are quite contagious. There's happiness seems to cluster, for example. There's a lot of social network studies that show this. So if you live in a neighborhood where people are happy and you know happy people, you tend to be happier yourself.
Huh. Well, Shelley Gable is the chair of the Psychological and Brain Sciences Department at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Professor Gable, hang on here for just a second, because we're talking this hour about empathetic joy, an ancient Buddhist concept that now is beginning to get more attention from modern day researchers. So we'll learn more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the concept and experience of empathetic joy and the science that's being built around the notion that we can experience internally very positive sensations when seeing joy in others. Now, this might sound obvious, right? But the truth is that, as we heard in the last segment, science is only beginning to understand why this happens. And it happens a lot, thank goodness, because when we put a call out earlier to you, On Point listeners, to share your experiences of empathetic joy, you delivered. Here's some of what you said.
I recently took my teenage daughter and a couple of her friends to a concert and haven't been to a concert in a long time. But back when I was younger, I saw a lot of concerts back in the 90s, in the grunge era. And this reminded me of that. And it was great to see teenagers basically rocking out like I didn't expect them to do anymore. And it was just a great thing to see.
Finally, after COVID restrictions dropped enough to be able to go to college graduation and hood my first PhD student, he had written a brilliant, complex, wonderful dissertation. I was so proud of him, and I spent the whole day floating on a cloud of bliss because of his happiness.
A friend of mine that I went to junior high school with, I found out that her feet were always hurting. She was married, but she had just been recently separated from her husband. So I bought her like a three pairs of the Nike VaporMax shoes that she really wanted. and took her out for a pedicure. And, you know, when we got together and I gave her the shoes and she was like, oh my God. And she just jumped around and danced and everything else. It was ridiculous. It was crazy. So in the end, I was like, you know, hey girl, it's all good. I'm just getting tired of hearing about your feet hurting. It was so awesome to see her joy in that situation. And I just felt great. It was awesome.
Find your own and another's good. The Buddhists call this mudita. There is enough to go around, they say. It's not a zero-sum game. Ah, so when you say your prayers tonight, we'll throw your pennies in the fountain. Spread some goodwill to someone else. There'll be more blessings for counting.
By the way, that last one is a song from On Point listener Lisa Redfern in Bath, Maine. Lisa, thank you so much for sending that to us. We also heard from listeners Rashad Smith in Virginia and Knowles in Maine, and from listener Paul Wilson as well. We're joined today by Shelley Gables. She's the chair of the Psychological and Brain Sciences Department at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and principal investigator at the Emotions, Motivation, Behavior, and Relationships Lab. And joining us now is Eve Ekman. She's a meditation teacher and contemplative social scientist. Eve Ekman, welcome to you.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
You know, you heard Lisa in that song that she sent us mention a specific word, the mudita. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, I loved hearing that song. That was such a joyful way to explain a somewhat complicated concept, this idea and word that may be unfamiliar, mudita, empathetic joy. It's this rejoicing. So Dr. Gable's already been talking about this a bit, but this idea that instead of comparing ourselves, instead of maybe feeling jealousy for the success and the wins of those around us, we rejoice with them. We actually feel good about the good that others are doing. Some of your listeners also shared that, but it's kind of a unique and specific way that we tune in to feeling good and being able to overcome, especially, which is so prevalent in our social media culture, but certainly throughout time, this idea of seeing someone else succeed and actually feeling bad about it ourselves.
Mm. Now, this is a description of something that seems to me to be fundamentally human. But the concept, the word mudita, that comes out of the Buddhist tradition, right?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So tell me then, is it more than just the experience, the spontaneous experience of empathetic joy? Is like true mudita something that needs to be consciously practiced and become a practice in life?
Yeah, so according to the contemplative traditions, which of course are maybe not as specific as the contemporary psychological science in terms of how they research, but we're talking about thousands of years of close observation. Mm-hmm. What helps me on a day-to-day basis? What supports me in being able to get through, especially some difficult times that many of us are facing? And when you look at mudita, you actually can't pull it out on its own. So empathetic joy is part of a whole network, and the network includes compassion, loving kindness, and equanimity. And these four experiences indeed are training for the mind and heart. You are absolutely right. They're natural. We can feel them all. We feel compassion and motivation to help when someone is struggling or suffering. But they are something we can train deliberately, which I believe Dr. Gable would also encourage, so that we can really find our way there on a day-to-day basis. And what we train explicitly day-to-day, maybe what today do I feel rejoicing in someone else's goodness, becomes more reflexive over time. So maybe we try to do it, and then all of a sudden we find it naturally comes alive for us.
Okay. Professor Gable, respond to what Eve Ekman's saying. What do you think?
I think she's absolutely correct. I think that this is definitely a trait or a skill that people can practice and learn better. Again, often I go back to the context of the relationship that we have with the people that are around us, and kind of putting aside things like jealousy or kind of just social comparison, because we care about these people and we want the best for them. I think that makes it easier to start with this empathetic way of experiencing their joy.
Okay. You know, I want to actually take a step back here for a second, because we will talk more about how to deliberately engage in this practice a little later on, because I feel like the world being what it is, many people would want to try and benefit from it. But Eve Ekman, I would actually first love to hear the story of what brought you to your closer study and thinking about empathetic joy, you know, in your own life, in your own work.
Yeah, thank you for that question. So for me, I'll just tell a really simple story. I think this is relatable for folks, that some of the times we know about these ideas like empathetic joy, and as both a researcher and a meditation practitioner, yeah, this sounds good. I can practice it when I meditate. But for me, it was a time in my life when I was single, recently heartbroken, and every time I saw a couple walk by me, I just was like so frustrated. And I thought, God, they're not really happy, or they'll break up soon, or I really couldn't be happy with them. And it made me unhappy. And so I tried to figure out a way of like, oh my gosh, there's already a tool for me to deal with these feelings that were honestly pretty hard. So every time I saw a couple walk by, I rejoiced in their smiling and in their laughter. And it just transformed it and brought it home for me of like, oh, I can use this every day. This isn't a concept in a book. This isn't something I want to research. This is actually something that helps me. And that was a real breakthrough for me. And now I can really practice that empathetic joy anytime and anywhere. There's so many opportunities for us on a day-to-day basis.
Huh. Now, you've been teaching meditation for, more than a decade now?
Yeah, just about up there. Yeah.
Okay. And so so this is, I mean, obviously part of that larger work that you do. Do you have examples of people that you've taught the skills of or the tool of mudita to, who particularly seem to need it?
Yeah, so I feel so fortunate. In my postdoctoral work, I was at UCSF, which is one of our medical centers up here in the Bay Area, and I did a training program there for physicians in training. And they are, you know, underslept, they are under constant evaluation, they are trying to do really good by helping others, and they're feeling overwhelmed, stressed out. We know about the levels of burnout in healthcare, and in the training years, it's actually a time that's well documented, our empathy declines. So there we are, committing our lives to helping others, and yet our experience can often be one where we feel disconnected or even callous. So in working with these residents, I really highlighted these opportunities for empathetic joy with one another. So sometimes it's overwhelming, especially when I was working in pediatrics, to see the suffering of children or the suffering of the parents of sick children. But what they were able to do was feel good about how their colleagues were showing up with kindness, showing up with care, and just attending to or directing their attention to this aspect that was happening throughout the day. It really increased their well-being without taking a vacation, without unfortunately getting more sleep. So that was a population I feel like really benefited from mudita.
Okay. Do you have to, well, so I was jumping ahead there. So forgive me, because there's just so many questions. But Professor Gable, let me turn back to you here. Because, you know, I think that we're using a particular phrase, empathetic joy. There are other ways to describe what we're talking about here, but that word empathy is really interesting to me, because oftentimes, I think most often when it's deployed, it's deployed in the sense of like feeling empathy towards others' suffering or others' negative feeling, you know, the whole I feel your pain kind of empathy here. But what we need, I guess what we're underscoring here is that there's an equally powerful, or is it equally powerful, to have a sort of positive empathy?
Right. And I think at the core of empathy is really understanding. And I think that's the piece that we often forget. And so understanding comes in all different forms. And when you're understanding someone's emotional experience, it could be their negative emotional experience, their pain, so to speak, or it could be their positive emotional experience, their joy. So I think both of those are possible, but we often default to thinking about this, you know, empathy as feeling someone's pain.
Okay. Well, you know, in trying to get a better understanding of that, of the this in, this sort of emerging intersection of how science is trying to understand empathetic joy better, we reached out to Jamil Zaki, professor of psychology at Stanford and director of the Stanford Social Neuroscience Lab.
In my own lab, we collect data where we have people engage in acts of kindness towards other people or have them watch while someone else, for instance, wins some money. We then have the person themselves who's having their brain scanned win money also.
Okay, so what does the brain look like when they're receiving that money, that reward, compared to when some folks see somebody else receive a reward?
Turns out the answer to that is pretty similar. There are parts of the brain, especially parts of the brain's dopamine system, that are engaged or activated both when something good happens to you and when you watch something good happen to somebody else.
And Zaki says that while the brain has the capacity to feel this empathetic joy, his research is finding that it matters who the other person is.
The closer that you are to someone, psychologically, whether that means that they're part of your group or part of your family or one of your good friends or your romantic partner, the stronger that that positive empathy is, both at the level of the brain and at the level of what people say they feel.
And finally, Professor Zaki tells us that positive empathy not only allows us to experience joy, but it is a foundation for kindness.
So we often think of empathy as promoting kindness because we feel bad with other people, and so we want to fix their problems. Well, it's also true that when someone else's joy feels like our joy, we're motivated to help them. In my own lab, we found that the more a person's brain is active when they see someone else win money, the more that they're likely to donate to charity and volunteer in their everyday lives. So just to recap, positive empathy is palpable and real. It tracks how close we feel to people, and it drives our kindness and connection to them.
That's Jamil Zaki, professor of psychology at Stanford University and director of the Stanford Social Neuroscience Lab. Professor Gable, obviously you and Professor Zaki, I'm sure, know each other quite well, but pick up on something important he said there, because you had mentioned it earlier, that perhaps the intensity of the empathetic joy a person feels is dependent on how close they feel to the other person. Is that sort of a, is that just, I was going to call it tribalism, but I don't think that that's not the right phrase. But what is at work there? Does it already have to be an extant relationship for us to feel empathetic joy?
Right. I don't think it has to be an extant relationship to begin with. I think, again, building relation, you know, feeling empathetic joy is part of what builds relationships. So it starts somewhere. But I think there, a lot of times we feel closer even to people who are similar to us, for example, who share similar likes to us, who maybe had a similar experience to us. Those are kind of the beginning blocks, building blocks of relationships to begin with. So I don't think it has to be a close person right away, but it certainly helps a lot. And as Dr. Zaki's work has shown beautifully, the closer that we are to someone, the more intense that positive empathy becomes. And this resonates with our work as well, because we've seen that the closer and more satisfied people are in their relationships, the more they're able to feel joy when their close others feel joy. And not only just feel that joy, but express that joy back to them, which again is part of what builds this intimate relationships.
Okay. So that makes a lot of sense. But it's also still quite remarkable how much empathetic joy a person can feel, even if they don't know the other human who's experiencing the joy at all, right? Because I'm seeing here that there's some research that shows, you know, they put folks in an fMRI machine to see what was going on in their brain. And even just watching, you know, moments of ecstatic joy on an episode of Extreme Makeover Home Edition produced measurable empathetic joy in the subject's brains, right?
Exactly. And again, I you know, there's an element of shared experience among many of us. And so I think that we can put ourselves in those, in the shoes of other people, even when they're experiencing, you know, an extreme makeover of a home, because we can think back to times that we've had similar experiences, or think back to, or think about, you know, how we are similar to those people and connected to them.
Yeah. You know, there is so much more interesting research, and the question of how we can further engage in this practice that we're going to take a look at when we come back, because the research is fascinating. Empathetic joy apparently strongly engages a whole series of brain circuits that begin in the prefrontal cortex and can maybe even help support mental processes like regulating emotion, planning, and decision making. So how can empathetic joy then spill over positively into other aspects of our lives? That's what we'll look at when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair. A new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the science of empathetic joy, the kind of joy we experience through the happiness of others. We're joined by Eve Ekman. She's a meditation teacher and a contemplative social scientist. We're also joined by Shelley Gable. She's a professor and the chair of the Psychological and Brain Sciences Department at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And once again, we heard a lot from you, On Point listeners, about your moments of empathetic joy. Here's some more of them.
So I just went to the Seattle Folklife Festival with my daughter, who turned 34. She wanted to celebrate her birthday there, which was the same birthday wish when she was 10 years old. She just was ecstatically happy, and I just derived great pleasure from that.
When I was a young man, I had a girlfriend who absolutely idolized Paul McCartney, and I was going to sell a guitar to Paul. For me, it was just a transaction. But I let her know, take time off from modeling. I didn't tell her why. And I dragged her up to CBS Studios where Paul and Linda were recording. And the joy in her face and the change in her life when she saw who we were going to meet was absolutely one of the finest moments of my life.
I am a 24/7, 365 caregiver for my mother, who is 84, and my mom can't walk independently. She can walk with assistance. Like she has good legs, but not good neurology to control her legs. And several months ago, we were fortunate enough to find out about a wheelchair that is outfitted with pedals that allows the rider to maneuver the wheelchair with their own power. And so we got one and we went to test drive it at the local mall. And when I saw her pedal away on her own,
It was the most amazing feeling of joy to know that she had that capability and she would have that little bit of feeling of independence and control over her life. And so that's my experience with empathetic joy.
That was Anne-Marie Kane from Maine. You also heard Stephen Pat from California and Loretta Lee McGinley from Washington State. Eve Ekman, Anne-Marie in particular, I mean, I think we all had to fight back tears in hearing her describe the really profound joy she felt in watching her mother regain a little bit of independence. I wonder, though, for people who are slightly more removed from us, it seems as if without practice, sometimes a response that could have been empathetic joy is something else, right? It becomes perhaps envy or jealousy. Do you understand what I mean, Eve?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Very common. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why we use empathetic joy not only to feel good, but to avoid some of those more painful feelings of wishing we had what others had, comparing ourselves to them. We can do this in person, of course, it's wonderful, but I really recommend trying this online. Many of us who are engaged on social media platforms, we see our friends or colleagues, we see their successes, we see their, you know, joyful kids running around, and we may think, oh my God, I wish I had that. Why don't I have that? So empathetic joy can be used even when we feel that kind of tightness or contraction in the heart, when we are separating ourselves from other, comparing, feeling different. And it's the opposite. We kind of tune in and lean towards this joy as though we were getting the lift underneath our wings of their joy to us.
How do you do that, though? Because let's just focus on, you brought up a potential, like the workplace example, and not even like on social media, but just let's say in the workplace. You know, I can imagine there are many, many times when a colleague who might even, you know, be a close friend already, or maybe not, let's say, just gets a, you know, a raise or some great feedback or something that one should feel happy about for their colleague. But instead, the first response is, you know, I wish I had that. And so how do you overcome what that initial response of envy might be? How do you get past that and more quickly come to a place of empathetic joy?
Yeah, great question. So common, I think, just so prevalent in our everyday work experiences. So I'll say two things. One maybe first strategy that we sometimes overlook, like we want to feel better, we want to, maybe we've heard this news program and we want to try it ourselves and we're very eager. But actually, it's important for us to just take a pause and notice that this experience is hard. I actually am feeling some jealousy. I feel like, you know, either what I have is threatened or I want something else. And to take a moment and be mindful and aware that there's a feeling of maybe fear or sadness or pain or hurt around it. It's a really important first step. That can be literally one breath. Just, oh, this is hard for me. And then the second one is to imagine how good this is for them. I think if we skip over that first step, which I'm describing as compassion for ourselves, we might do something that feels a little dry or a little brittle and, oh God, I'm happy for them, but it won't actually sink in. The other thing I'll say, the second step, is we might have to try this and practice it and not feel that good at it, and that's okay. So we're giving ourselves that motivation is, I want to feel good with this person. I hope that they enjoy this. I hope that their family is proud of them, their partner's proud of them. And we might, again, say that silently to ourselves. And the first couple times it feels a little rigid or unnatural. But slowly, we start to really be able to imagine they're feeling good or see them feeling good. And it starts to soften or shift for us. But I think if we expect it to change in a moment, that might be a little disappointing.
Mm. But it sounds like you're saying that we have to be deliberate in slowing things down a little, creating a time and space, just almost sort of reset, recognize and reset what our reactions are.
Yeah, and the time and space truly can be 3 to 5 breaths. Mm-hmm. So having the good fortune to work in healthcare, I've worked in education and also criminal justice, you know, folks who don't have time, like most of us. So if we use those words of set aside time, we're like, oh yeah, maybe I'll do that, you know, on vacation or my next job. But to really think of it as on the spot and in the moment. So that first feelings, the first thing we have to do is actually become aware of our emotions and to notice, wow, I don't feel good right now. This is hard not feeling good. Maybe I can try and practice on my next breath to be happy with this person. And using our breath is powerful because our breath exists outside of our conscious awareness. And if we bring it to the surface, we pay attention to it, then all of a sudden we can add this piece of sending or extending that feeling of rejoicing, of joy with this person on our breath. So it's a kind of a behavioral cue, tying the practice with our very breath.
Oh, Eve, you in hearing you describe it, it sounds like it should be so easy and simple. But look, I will real talk here. Everyone who knows me well knows that oftentimes I can get hijacked by my negative emotions, to be perfectly frank.
Yeah.
And I really use that phrase like hijack, like because we're trying to find, like mm-hmm. you said, those that 3 to 5. The space of 3 to 5 breaths, but like it seems as if the steam engine has already left the station before I can find those 3 to 5 breaths, and so using my still developing self-awareness as an example, Professor Gable, let me turn back to you because I think I maybe take a little bit of heart in the fact that I'm not alone because I'm seeing that there are studies, the one not so long ago from the published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology that finds that in a lot of situations, people are more likely to, they're just more likely to feel envy first, or more likely to feel envy than sympathetic joy in the types of situations that we talked about. Is there a reason for that? Is there something about the emotion of envy that makes it more automatic than sympathetic joy or empathetic joy?
That's a really interesting question. I think that, again, our first reaction may be that envy reaction. And I think it has a lot to do with, we have, our self, and we need to kind of always see where we stand in the world. And often that means in relation to other people. So we're often doing these social comparisons. And so it's pretty natural to kind of look around and see kind of where do I stand? What do I have? What am I doing? And those are I think that's why envy can be one of the first reactions that we have, but totally resonate with what Eve is saying because, in the relationships field, we talk about this idea of transformation of motivation. And what that really means is, you may have an initial reaction to a close other, but then you start thinking about the relationship itself or the other person, and you kind of put them first as opposed to your own kind of needs and, kind of knee-jerk reaction, so to speak. And once you start doing that, that's when it's easier to kind of transform that motivation into something more constructive for the other person and for the relationship itself.
Mm. So, throughout this whole conversation, I've been experiencing, I'll be honest, a kind of a duality of emotions. One is this just excitement and thrill about how powerful empathetic joy is and can be, and how we can further cultivate it in our lives. The other set of feelings is kind of a little bit of hopelessness. And here's why. Because maybe it's being in the news business. I don't know what the toxic stew of news has done to shape my brain over the past many years. But when I look around in society, whether it be social media, which we know is engineered to emphasize negative emotions, or just the modern world where we're confronted every day so much with competition that we may feel in our workplaces, or the stresses of the pandemic, the tragedies of the pandemic, of war, of capitalism as an economic system, you name it. It seems to me that culturally, the forces are more aligned against growing and experiencing more empathetic joy than they ought to be, Eve. I mean, am I being too negative here?
Well, I'd like to disagree with you. I completely agree that it is, these are hard times, but I also take quite a bit of confidence in reading about the historical time where Buddha was, you know, proposed to have lived. And if there's maybe anything worse than, you know, raw capitalism, it might be intense monarchies, right? And all these kingdoms and just profound inequality. This caste system that prevented people from moving upwards in any way. And you look at, that's the time when these teachings were first developed, to address this enormous inequality, warfare all the time, so much disease and not a lot of medical care. So I think we're not exceptional, unfortunately, in this time of really having a lot of struggles and difficulties. I think what is exceptional is how much we are aware of them. So I definitely agree that we need these kind of tools and strategies to work every day. And I'll just make one more plug here for emotion awareness. This is kind of foundational. You talked about being hijacked, that wonderful term that Danny Goleman kind of brought into our contemporary vernacular of the emotion running away with us. One way we can really start to develop our emotion awareness is paying attention to our bodies. That might be counterintuitive, right? We want something that we learn or that we write about or someone tells us, but as we pay attention to our bodies, we may become aware of the energy or experience of emotion. And what can feel like an unpleasant emotion can be an opportunity for us to reframe it, to change it, to have compassion, to have care. So I think it's a really essential part. We have to start at the foundation of recognizing what anger feels like in the chest versus what fear feels like, maybe around the jaw. And as we become aware, we have more choice. As you mentioned, the choice is hard. It's still hard to choose and really go towards what can be sustainably good for us and others. But it's somewhere to start and something all of us have the capacity to do. Dr. Gable will probably know more on the research of interoception or this embodied emotion awareness can help us be empathetic towards others.
Professor Gable, do you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, I agree again with Eve. And what I would say also is that I think in these times, it's actually when we need the positive empathy the most, when, you know, things look so bleak sometimes and the news is constantly negative. One of the things that we found in our research is that when we feel empathetic joy with those close to us, it actually builds those relationships, and they're more likely to be there for us. Those people we're feeling joy for and expressing that to, they're more likely to be there for us when things go wrong and we do need someone to reach out and perhaps have that negative empathy and connect with us. So it's all connected in that sense. And I think we forget about these positive moments as these opportunities to build those relationships and make those connections that are going to actually help us when we have, harder times. Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a lot of suggestions on how to build the capacity for empathetic joy. One of the most interesting ones I've run across is watch a sporting event or a competition, but don't take sides. So no matter who wins, you will experience joy. But in the last 30 seconds or so that we have, Eve, if there's one thing that listeners could incorporate into their lives right now after hearing this hour to help them down this road, what would you recommend it be?
Yeah, I think the easiest way is to look for opportunities where it's available. And that doesn't have to be just other human beings. Actually, we can extend this to the more than human world. So feeling empathetic joy with the sunlight, with the breeze, with the shade, feeling a sense of joy, seeing a mother embrace her child on the street, any opportunity and every opportunity, use it to practice. Feel your breath and notice that feeling of joy, that lifting with others.
Or rejoicing, as you said as well. It's a word I love to use in this context. So Eve Ekman, meditation teacher and contemplative social scientist, thank you so much for joining us today, Eve.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Shelley Gable, professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. It's been a great pleasure to have you on, Professor Gable. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.